You're listening to Let's Talk Creation with Todd Wood and Paul Garner, the creation show where we learn, grow, and worship.
Well, welcome everybody to another episode of Let's Talk Creation with Paul Garner and Todd Wood. I am Paul Garner.
And I am Todd Wood.
As always, don't forget to subscribe, like and share our episode, share them with your friends. And do leave a comment or a question. I guess at some point Todd will come back and do another Q&A episode. So we like to get people's questions coming in. And all of that really helps us to sort of reach out to new listeners. So please do that and leave us a review as well on your favorite podcast streaming platform. Todd, today I'm looking forward to this episode because we've both been inspired by other creation scientists over the years. And one of the great things about doing this podcast is the opportunity it gives us to talk to many of them and to share some of their insights and some of their ideas with our audience. And I am particularly excited today because we're going to be talking to a creation geologist whose work has definitely been an inspiration to me and I know to lots of others. So I think this is going to be a really fascinating conversation.
Yeah, I agree. I think this is, for me, when I'm a little starry-eyed during an interview because I start talking about when I was just a student, I got your book. Well, this is another one of those, when I was just a student, I got your book, and it really made a massive impact on me. So I'm really looking forward to our guest. And who is the guest?
Well, I'm going to read out from his bio because I've got to read this. This is just fantastic, right? So according to his bio, our guest has carried out fieldwork on 6 of the 7 continents of the world.
All right.
His research has taken him by helicopter into the crater on Mount St. Helens, by bush plane onto glaciers in Alaska, by raft through the Grand Canyon, on horseback into the High Sierra, by elevator into the world's deepest coal mines, by scuba onto the Great Barrier Reef, by rail into the Korean backcountry, by foot onto the barren plateaus of southern Argentina, and by four-wheel drive into the remote desert areas of Israel, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia. Now, I don't know about you, but that sounds like someone who we could describe as the Indiana Jones of creationism.
Pretty close to and it. It sounds like we need to book him a tour to Antarctica, though.
Just to make it complete, right? That's right. Tick the box, yeah. He is, of course, Dr. Steve Austin. Steve, welcome to the show. We are delighted to have you.
It's good to be here, Paul and Todd. Just looking forward to doing a little summary of kind of the career of a geologist.
Yeah, that's what we thought we'd do today. This is kind of the life of a creation geologist. And so there's a bit of sort of biography in this. And we thought we'd just start by giving you the opportunity, Steve, just to sort of fill in. I mean, I've given you that amazing sort of bio there, but I'm sure there are all sorts of other details. So just fill in some of those for us, particularly your kind of educational academic sort of career as well.
Well, let me just say that I'm not going to talk a lot about science. I'm going to talk a lot about the interpretation of science. Okay, and maybe that will kind of give you a taste of what it's like to be a geologist going to 6 continents. Maybe I'll get to Australia.
Steve,
you can
Steve,
talk
is it,
to
is
me.
It,
my, I,
is it Australia that you haven't ahead. Been to? Is it Australia you haven't been to? We thought it was Antarctica you haven't been to.
I've been all over Australia.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Antarctica. I haven't been to Antarctica.
Right. That's where we need to buy the plane ticket.
Yeah. I haven't been to Antarctica, and there's a lot of good things I want to check off. Mount Erebus is a volcano, and Antarctica, and I definitely want to go see that because it's like Mount St. Helens. But, okay, so I'd like to talk to you about my career as a geologist. And maybe some high points on the where the science impacted me most. Maybe that's the way to say it. And maybe the first thing to talk about is my childhood. And And you could do a whole broadcast or a podcast on that subject. But my mom was a chemist, but she was a housewife. She had a degree in chemistry, worked for DuPont. And my dad was a maintenance inspector, United Airlines. And he oversaw the fixing of the engines and the controls of prop aircraft, the United Airlines. And but he was a prospector. His hobby was prospecting. And so I got out and looked at a lot of placer gold, and he was interested also in radioactive minerals. So I learned about carnotite and other things like that. By the time I was 4 years old, I saw my first geologic map and started collecting rocks. And when I was 8 years old, I was possessing an enormous rock collection. Every square inch under my bed was occupied by rocks. Okay, and I see Paul smiling because he's also a geologist and gets afflicted with these things. And then my rock collection went to school, and the teachers asked about my rock collection. When I was 8 years old, a TV program in San Francisco on KQED television put on mystery objects. I started identifying mystery objects that were on TV, and eventually my mom got a letter from the TV studio. Is this guy for real? And they wanted me to be on television. And so I was on television for 3 years, and I met a whole bunch of scientists. It was really cool. And so I'm in the green room at a television studio meeting a scientist. You get to ask them a whole bunch of questions or get their advice. And it was good time to meet these people. And I became the boy that wanted to build Brontosaurus. Okay. I see Paul smiling because I don't think I've told him this part of the story. But I remember in 1953, the Life magazine came out with Brontosaurus on the front cover. And from then on, I was hooked. I was interested in dinos and rocks and minerals and all that kind of thing. So, and then when I got interested in dinosaurs, I got a very big disappointment. Okay. This happened over a 10-year period, but I realized that everything on the front cover of Life magazine with the Brontosaurus was wrong. About the only thing that was right was they had part of the fossil. But I learned that they had the wrong head on the Brontosaurus. And in the quarry site at Dinosaur National Monument, Earl, the dinosaur paleontologist inserted the wrong skull on the articulated animal and called it Brontosaurus. And Douglas, the paleontologist, had built a chimera dinosaur that really didn't exist. And it was a body of an Apatosaurus and the skull of a Diplodocus that was assembled to make Brontosaurus. And that disappointed me really bad, because we had the wrong terminology on the dinosaur. And for a kid like me, interested in the details, I wanted to build a Brontosaurus in my backyard, and the parts list was defective, and I couldn't build them. And you know, Brontosaurus lived in this kind of lush park, you know, along the channel of a meandering river, okay? And the more I thought about the dinosaur outcrop and the quarry wall at Dinosaur National Monument, the more objections I had to it. Now, the most important fossil, abundant fossil on the outcrop is not dinosaur, it's Unio, a clam fossil. And so I started thinking about the meandering river with clam fossils. No, I can't. That's an ocean organism. So how do you build the whole habitat of the dinosaur? Well, of course, he lived on the dinosaur environment with the bank of the river, and of course, he chewed ferns. And in the background are all these carnivorous dinosaurs and all that kind of thing that went on. Mm-hmm. I realized that it's a bogus picture. And then I started reflecting on it. When I was about 15, I was sure that geology was agenda-driven science. And people have these images that drive their interpretation of the data. And agenda-driven science was all around me. And I realized it's uniformitarian doctrine. And then when I took geology program in high school, believe it or not, there was a semester class on geology. I encountered uniformitarianism, and in the textbook, it was a scientific law like any other law of science. It's considered valid because all known facts conform to it. Okay, and I said, this is baloney. In my textbook in high school, I could see this false agenda, okay? And it wasn't evolution per se that generated it. It was uniformitarian thinking. So I was ready to expunge that way of thinking from doing science. And when I went to University of Washington in Seattle, Washington, that's when my advisor said, Steve, if you continue to think this way about agenda-driven science, you'll be of no value as a geologist, okay? And so go lightly on this way of thinking, and you can benefit from the education it will give you at this university. So I spent more time at the university reading journals than I did reading textbooks for my courses. And I basically ditched uniformitarian geology. And I read, when I was 12 years old, I read George Gaylord Simpson's book, The Meaning of Evolution. And I realized that evolution was derived from this uniformitarian agenda that pervades geology. And I want to think creatively about alternates to evolution, but I need to think right about geology. And so when I went to school at undergraduate school, I just started reading journals profusely. And what I did is I had written my master's thesis when I was an undergraduate student. And I had my thesis in my back pocket, ready to go to graduate school. And what I did is I just basically said to the geology program at San Jose State University, would you accept a thesis on this subject, critique of uniformitarianism? In other words, I'm going to give you critical reasons why you don't want to think about uniformitarianism as an agenda to drive geology. And the department chairman said, yes, we'll accept a thesis like that. And so I submitted 11 months later, I completed all the courses, and then I submitted the thesis and critique of uniformitarianism. And I don't want to go into all the details of what happened, but just realize that it happened. Okay. And the details that allowed me to critique the whole paradigm of geology in a thesis, and I had permission. So what happened is I went to graduate school, and in graduate school, I started working on my dissertation before I even went to graduate school. And so I asked the professors at Penn State University, would you accept a thesis on coal geology of a coal bed in Kentucky? And they realized I'd written a thesis on critique of uniformitarianism. And it became an interesting subject to the graduate school. And then I went and did a PhD on the origin of coal. When I did the PhD dissertation, I framed the problem during the energy crisis in the mid-70s. I stated it as a what would you say? I stated it as a a proposition, and the proposition, the conventional theory for the origin of coal. And I want to contrast that with some other model. But anyway, the PhD dissertation was on the Kentucky number 12 coal bed in Western Kentucky. And over a 4-year period, I minutely studied the structure of the coal bed, the composition, texture, structure, form, and association of the coal bed, six different things about the coal bed. And when I came away, my professor said, in six different chapters, you've disproven the swamp origin for the coal bed in Kentucky. And you've done it to our satisfaction. And then, you know what he said? He said, you can't turn in a dissertation disproving a theory. You can't do that. And you got to come up with your own theory for the origin of the coal bed in Western Kentucky, not disprove a theory. Okay. And so he asked for it. In my back pocket, I had chapter 7 of my PhD dissertation, which was on the floating mat model for the origin of coal. Yeah, I can see Paul there smiling because he knows the rest of the story now. Well, yeah. 10 months after I turned in my PhD dissertation, Mount St. Helens exploded and made a floating log mat for me to study. And yeah, it was a cool thing. Anyway, yeah. Go ahead.
Well, Paul. I was just going to say that kind of brings us then to your interest in Mount St. Helens. Right. And this has been such a, you know, many people will know you for your research on Mount St. Helens. That's perhaps how they first encountered you, you know, speaking about that. And it's been a lifelong study, hasn't it? So yeah, tell us about Mount St. Helens.
So a graduate of University of Washington who had a favorite volcano in the Cascade Range, it's called Mount St. Helens, he had written his dissertation in 1979 on the floating mat model for the origin of coal. And then I discovered something at Mount St. Helens. There was a gigantic floating mat of dead logs, several square miles in area on the lake north of Mount St. Helens. And so it became a living laboratory for studying the origin of coal. I asked D. James Kennedy, a Calvinist theologian. You know about Calvinism, and I'm not exactly a wholehearted 5-point Calvinist, but I wanted to know what he thought, and you know, what are the odds that I would study geology at University of Washington next to Mount St. Helens. And what are the odds that I'd write a thesis on the origin of coal, disproving the conventional explanation, and writing about a really harebrained idea of a coal bed forming underneath a floating log mat. And then 10 months later, it happened, a living modern example of a floating log mat. D. James Kennedy said, yes, God causes the affairs of man and nature to cross. And so that began my career as a professional creation geologist. And I think I'm the first to be employed by a creation organization full-time as a geologist. That was 1979, right before Mount St. Helens exploded. I'm established as a researcher at Institute for Creation Research. Mount St. Helens was a good experience.
There weren't many creationists with a PhD in geology at that time. I don't know how many there were, but there weren't many, were there?
One.
Me. Was there just you? Was there anybody before you?
There was. Leonard Brand was a couple other people from the zoology side came in, and were in the field very early. Leonard Brand and Clifford Burdick had a PhD from the University of Arizona, but after he became a creationist, they refused his degree. They got it bound up in politics,
right,
and he never was conferred a PhD technically until months later, years later.
So
it was kind of early. So what happened at Mount St. Helens was Disneyland for me, right? That was Disneyland. Okay. And everything was formed rapidly. And boy, was there a lot formed rapidly, like a peat layer was buried on the bottom of the lake. Obviously, that's the only thing that I believed was possible. The other things I would have argued against, you know, rapidly formed strata, you know, laminated strata, we think of that as forming slowly. No, it wouldn't form in a hurricane at 100 mile per hour. That thing can't happen. Erosion, that can't happen. Erosion of canyons, even solid rock, hundreds of feet deep, that can't happen. And sure enough, it did. It happened at Mount St. Helens. And then origin of coal. So everything was kind of cool right there. D. James Kennedy said, yes, God causes the affairs of man and nature to cross. And so now I'm, what else should I do? And that's when I'm in Southern California and San Diego area. Of course, one of my favorite places on earth is Grand Canyon. And so I started leading field trips to Grand Canyon. We got school buses. And we'd get a school bus and get 50 people in the school bus and drive out to Grand Canyon. And then we started getting contract busing, like Greyhound bus and Trailways and that kind of thing. And we started leading rim tours and then hikes in Grand Canyon, raft trips through Grand Canyon, helicopter overflights of Grand Canyon, that kind of thing. And Grand Canyon became my favorite place to live, basically. Mount St. Helens, next to an active volcano, and lots of geologic activity like landslides and whatnot. Grand Canyon is more to my liking. So then we started studying the fossil layer of Grand Canyon, started studying the erosion of Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
How well do we know the fossil layers of Grand Canyon? The Uniform Agenda uniformitarian agenda has driven science. And so there's a lot of things I believe we can learn at Grand Canyon. And so I specialized in one limestone layer in Grand Canyon, a redwall limestone fossil deposit. And then the other thing that bothered me about Grand Canyon was the uniformitarian agenda about how Grand Canyon formed very slowly by the Colorado River over tens of millions of years since the age of dinosaurs, basically. And I discovered that we don't have a unified theory on the erosion of Grand Canyon, and we know next to nothing about the fossil deposits, the real interpretations. So that's when I studying those things.
Yeah. Now, I remember back in 2004, I had the great privilege of being on a Grand Canyon raft trip that you led along with Andrew Snelling.
Yes.
And I remember seeing the fossil nautiloids in the nautiloid bed. So, I mean, tell us a bit about how you kind of discovered that nautiloid layer and how you traced it along the length of the canyon. Tell us about that.
Well, I didn't discover the nautiloid layer. A boatman on a Grand Canyon River trip told me about I was just saying, hey, where's your favorite fossil deposit? So there's this one out in Nautiloid Canyon. Okay, it has a name already. It's where nautiloids occur. And so that's what got me there. I don't want to talk about a 35-year investigation in 10 minutes, even 5 minutes. Okay. But there were 80 nautiloids on the ledge, and I discovered eventually after a couple years that it was very extensive. It went down 3 miles along the river in Grand Canyon. And then I asked, well, how widespread is the fossil layer with these large squid-like organisms in a shell? They're squid in a shell, and they taper 1-to-7 ratio. And there's a whole bunch of them. I was seeing hundreds at the end of 1998. I had seen hundreds. By 1999, I was asking, could this be an extensive layer in Grand Canyon? And so I started pursuing it as an extensive layer. And then I started finding nautiloids along the whole Grand Canyon. Through 100 miles of Grand Canyon, I was finding nautiloids. And I talked to the nautiloid expert in Alan Titus, the North American nautiloid expert, PhD in paleontology of nautiloids. And I'm talking to him about the widespread nautiloids in Grand Canyon. And he said, how many have you seen? And I told him, I've drawn pictures of 1,000 nautiloids. How many have you seen? Large nautiloids. He says, you've seen more nautiloids, large nautiloids than I have. And you've seen them all in one layer. And so all that happened. I started discovering nautiloids to the west of Grand Canyon in Lake Mead area. Then I started finding nautiloids over in Las Vegas on Frenchman Mountain. And so the whole length of the nautiloid deposit, the 2 meter thick layer, 7 feet in thickness, nautiloids in the center of the nautiloid bed is about 160 miles long. Wow. So we found nautiloids, and I've drawn pictures of thousands. How many I've seen, I don't know. But it's a very extensive deposit. And I had a thesis student work for me, Derry Stansbury, and Derry was studying the how the fossil deposit ends. That was his master's thesis. How does the nautiloid deposit end? It's a 2 meter thick layer that goes 160 miles through Grand Canyon out to Lake Mead area and in Nevada into Las Vegas, right on the mountain just directly east, high eye level with the Stratosphere Hotel. is our nautiloids out there in Nevada. And so I give him the project of how does a nautiloid bed end. And guess what? He did his thesis on how it ends, but he couldn't find the end. It goes for another 100 miles to the west, and he still never found the end of it. And it becomes bigger every year, and so we need to continue to study it. Anyway, I proposed a mechanism where it formed by an underwater debris flow, essentially a hydroplaning, high-density flow that moved at about 6 meters per second over the bottom of the ocean. And it flowed over essentially a level surface, and I performed the modeling of it using 1D equations. The 1D equations are balancing pressure, essentially. I did a pressure balance, and it indicated to me that the debris flow would be stable at about meters per second velocity. And then some modelers made it in a deep tank called the fish tank at St. Anthony Falls Lab in Minneapolis, Minnesota. So, and then I had a computer modeler, a computational fluid dynamicist, model that using 2D equations. And 2D simulation is a much better than a 1D simulation. So I gave him the project. Hey, can you solve this make a model using 2D of a fast moving debris flow? And he did it. He did it with 2D. And I remember giving him the problem. You can do it on 2D. I can do it 1D, 6 meters per second. He modeled it 2D. And when I called him back after giving him the problem, I said, how did it go with that computer modeling of that high velocity flow? And he said, I remember the phone call. Wow. They fly. And he spent all of his time emphasizing fly. Okay. After he modeled it, he said, and he made a two-dimensional cross section of the flow using computational fluid dynamics. And it was a streamlined wing shape. Over the top of it, it had low pressure. Underneath it, it had high pressure, and he said, wow, they fly. And he it was aerodynamically or hydrodynamically a wing that moved at about, like I guessed, about 6 meters per second. And it had a hydroplane under the leading edge of the wing shape, and it could form the nautiloid deposit.
That's fantastic. And do you think, Steve, that's typical of how other beds within the Red Wall Limestone were deposited, even the ones that, say, don't have a nautiloid population buried in them?
Yeah, not abundant nautiloids, but I think the other coarse sandy limestone deposit were deposited by debris flow. And there's a lot of implications to go on this. What I'm interested in doing is attracting other creation scientists to thinking of nautiloid deposits as underwater debris flows forming at very high velocity. And for example, there's one in St. Louis, Missouri, in the Ordovician. There's an Ordovician nautiloid deposit. The nautiloids have orientation. That's one of the scientific observations about the nautiloid deposit in Grand Canyon. And they're buried rapidly because there's vertically standing nautiloids, tip end down in the nautiloid bed. Yeah. And so, Zach Klein, for example, he's a geology student, and he's very interested in nautiloids. And so other nautiloids, they're in Arkansas, they're in Illinois, they're in St. Louis, Missouri, obviously. And so they look like debris flows as well. So
Yeah,
mass kill deposits.
I got to see the Nautiloids with Zach last summer. He took me out in the field and we discovered some more Nautiloids. We went looking for some more in some other road cuts and we found more. So yeah, that
It's
was fun.
a highly addictive subject, okay?
Yeah.
You probably sense that, right?
Yeah.
And those are big nautiloids that he was discovering,
Yeah.
right? How big
Yeah.
were the ones you saw?
Maybe a foot long.
Yeah. Most of what I was seeing about the length of your arm, 2 feet long on the average. But yeah, so these nautiloids are abundant. And so we need to think outside the box. And this is not slow death on a calm and placid ocean floor.
Sure.
No, it's not the cumulative deposition of an inch every 1,000 years in a calm and placid epicontinental sea. That's junk science, the way I would think of it.
Yeah.
And so we need to think outside the box.
And one of the
And
other things, Steve, just to kind of shift gear a bit, with regards to Grand Canyon, that I know you've been very interested in is, and you mentioned it earlier, how Grand Canyon was carved.
yes.
So tell us a bit about that as well. That's a
Well,
fascinating story.
yeah. Okay. Over the years of studying Grand Canyon, I realized that geologists had no comprehensive story to tell about Grand Canyon erosion. You'd think it would be an easy problem to solve, wouldn't you? Like the Colorado River carved it over tens of millions of years. That's the conventional that I learned in high school. But when I went to graduate school, I learned that that's junk science. And not a lot of geologists want to talk about the evidence of that subject. And of slow and gradual erosion of Grand Canyon over tens of millions of years. It appears that Grand Canyon formed abruptly during the Pliocene, which would be just recently in geologic history. And all of a sudden, the canyon is there, and there's an ice age upstream. And whatever started thinking very early, about 35 years ago, about Grand Canyon formed from overtopping of lakes. Now there's a giant geologic structure, fold structure called the monocline, East Kaibab monocline, directly east of Grand Canyon. And that makes the upwarp Kaibab Plateau, which is a barrier. And there could be a lake behind that barrier. And so over the years, I've been studying that lake and the evidence of the lake. And I've been interested in finding the deposits and the erosional terraces near the shoreline of that lake. And yeah, there is really good evidence of a shoreline of a big lake. And how big's a lake? It's about the size of Lake Michigan. Okay. Directly east of Grand Canyon, like a smoking gun at the scene of a crime, okay, to me. So why not think that way about catastrophic drainage of a lake over the plateau? And so that's what I kind of became very interested in. And I've generated this theory over 35 years, and about 20 geologists that I know or are familiar with also think highly of the explanation. And they're thinking the same way. These people have PhDs and they're thinking about spillover models for a lake forming Grand Canyon. And in other words, there's a catastrophic explanation for the erosion of Grand Canyon, and it happens in a fraction of a million years. And it's uniformitarianism leads to junk science when thinking about erosion of Grand Canyon. And there got to be more outside the box, catastrophic ways of thinking. And yeah. I've spent a lot of time thinking about that. And in the last 10 years, I've done quite a bit of field work off to the east of Grand Canyon, working with the lake model for the erosion of Grand Canyon. So is it a little time and a lot of water, a catastrophic explanation, or is it a lot of time and just a little trickle of water, the Colorado River eroding Grand Canyon? So it's nice to think outside the box, because it's starting to generate good ways of thinking.
Yeah, that's great. Well, we've touched on, you know, a number of aspects of your sort of career in creation geology, but one that we haven't talked about yet, and we ought to mention, is your interest in earthquakes, and in particular, the earthquakes which are recorded in the Bible.
Yeah.
So tell us about that. I mean, why do earthquakes occur so frequently in the Holy Land, Steve? I mean, that maybe we could begin there.
Yeah, it's a fault called the Dead Sea Jordan Fault, and it's along the Dead Sea, and that's why earthquakes are very abundant in the Holy Land. And I've known that earthquake fault, its two plate boundaries, has been involved with the history. We have 4,000 years of history, right, from the Bible to the present, in the Holy Land. So it's like the San Andreas Fault in California, which only has 250 years of recorded history. Dead Sea Jordan Rift Fault, the boundary between the plates in the Middle East, that is 4,000 year history. It's a complicated story about paradigm systems, but let me introduce it by just my way of thinking. As I read the Bible, there are a lot of earthquakes in the Bible, right? If you start thinking about it, there's at least 10 big ones in the Bible. The earthquake at the cross when Jesus dies, the earthquake at the resurrection, when at the tomb. There's earthquakes during the time of Herod the Great, which forms the context of the New Testament, which there'll be earthquakes in diverse places. Jesus is referring to all the earthquakes that have been occurring over history in the Holy Land. And of course, the flood and creation are told in earthquake kind of imagery. And I discovered something. I need to talk to Bible and psychology majors at a liberal arts college, and I need to talk to them in a certain way. I can't talk to them about science directly. If you're a Bible major or a psychology major, you got to hear a different way of beginning the story. You can't begin with science. So what I did was at Christian Heritage College, when I was originally teaching there, the science program, in the science program, I started developing lunch lectures. And the lunch lecture was for anybody interested in hearing something that's interesting to everybody, but from a scientist. And so I talked about events in prophecy. And I had a lecture that I was told to develop. And what I developed was a lecture on you need to know about earthquakes, because they're mentioned in prophecy. And I took the 14th chapter of Jeremiah and developed the thought, you shall flee as you fled before the earthquake in days of Uzziah, king of Judah. And then Jesus will come back during the exodus of the city by the survivors of a giant earthquake. They'll be rescued from the earthquake, by the Mount of Olives splitting in two, and they'll flee eastward to Azel from the through the giant earthquake fault that's produced. And you need to know about this because you're going to come back with Jesus, and Jesus is going to be there. So you'll be there to see the giant earthquake. And that was the venue for the science. And when I gave that lecture, I mused about it to the students. And I said, hey, that must have been a big earthquake back there in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah, because you're going to flee before the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, Judah. You're going to flee like that when Messiah comes back and the Mount of Olives splits and Jesus comes back to reign on earth. And so I argued to the psych and to the Bible majors, you need to consider this big earthquake in the days of Uzziah, 750 BC, because that's a huge earthquake. And I argued it from the standpoint of history. And so I said, hey, you people here in San Diego, how many of you heard about the earthquake in 1906, the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco? And nobody raised their hand. Then I said, how many after the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah, 750 BC, that's the time of Isaiah, 230 years later, after the exile, the returned captives from Babylon are returned to Jerusalem, and Zechariah says, hey, you guys, you remember the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah? That's what it's going to be like when Jesus returns. In other words, he recalled the earthquake 230 years before. And nobody could remember the earthquake 70 years before in San Francisco. Not even a grandfather could tell them or anything about the earthquake on the San Andreas Fault. How about the earthquake 230 years later? Well, here's what happened. I said to the student, I said to one of the students, can you remember the earthquake? And no. This kid came up. He was a graduate. He was a senior in biology. He was a major in Bible. And he says, I'm going to the Institute for Holy Land Studies in Jerusalem, and I'll take a look for the earthquake. And I'm specializing on iron 2B architecture, and I'll let you know how I'll do it. So I said, somebody ought to go look for the earthquake evidence. And he took up the task. And for a period of 17 years, he reported back to me all the earthquake evidence he was finding in iron 2B architecture. And at the end of 17 years, this is in about 1990, I'm saying to him, I got to go see what you're finding. And so I started looking at architecture in all the archaeological sites that he had discovered earthquake evidence. And I discovered I had the skill set to analyze the sediment in the bottom of the lake. And so I started looking for the evidence of Uzziah's earthquake. Amos's earthquake is what I call it, because the book of Amos is dated by the earthquake. So I found a big, huge disturbed sediment layer back there at 750 BC, just like Amos said. And it's a huge earthquake. And it's the largest earthquake in 4,000 years in Upper Dead Sea sediment record. So anyway, the short story is I started looking for all the other earthquake evidence of the Bible, the other biblical earthquakes, and started finding them, and right where they should be, in about 9 meters thickness of sediment the last 4,000 years in the Dead Sea, there's an earthquake record strongly confirming the Bible and the climate change of the Bible. So I, you know, climate change and global warming is the model, right? Everybody's talking about, I can talk about global warming in Dead Sea sediment. And there've been a lot of periods where it's been warmer in biblical history than at present. Not really alarmed by too much by global warming today, because it's been a lot warmer back in Middle East history and medieval history, and that during the time of Christ, the lake level was higher and was even warmer then. So anyway, that led to a whole bunch of interesting subjects. So what would you say about a career as a creation geologist? It's been kind of an over the top experience, and that's what's led me around to geology on other continents and looking at Bible history from the standpoint of geology.
Yeah.
Sedimentary record. I believe there's a 1 centimeter thick layer in the bottom of Dead Sea that was formed about plus or minus 3 or 4 years of the time, about 33 AD, plus or minus 3 or 4 years. What could that be? Could that be the earthquake at the cross? I think it's there in the sediment. Amos's earthquake is there. The earthquake, other big earthquake is the time of Josephus and Herod's earthquake, 31 BC. The 31 BC earthquake is a big earthquake that sets the context for earthquakes in the rest of the New Testament. And there's earthquake records going back, probably Sodom and Gomorrah time. I think I'm seeing earthquake evidence there. And of course, the Bible flood, the Genesis flood is a gigantic earthquake. And so you're seeing sedimentary evidence of gigantic earthquakes in the past, and creation evidence. You know, the biggest tectonic event in the history of planet Earth is probably day 3 of creation week. God caused the waters to be collected together in the oceans, and he called them seas, and the dry land, he called it, continent. And there's big earthquake evidence in the Bible, totally consistent with the biblical framework. Yeah. So is it a good time to be a geologist studying Earth history and the Bible? Yeah, cool thing happened. So my career as a geologist is it is like Indiana Jones in a way. And it's to see thinking outside the box kind of thinking. Now, Let me talk about geology just one last thing. You know, people are starting to think catastrophic thoughts, right? And they're starting to notice things. There's catastrophic evidence all around in geology. And people like me are thinking outside the box. And they're starting to appreciate my way of thinking outside the box, like a gigantic fossil deposit in Grand Canyon, like a lake draining to make Grand Canyon, like, hey, Mount St. Helens, a miniature scale model of Noah's flood, basically, that kind of thing. So it's a cool thing to happen.
Yeah.
So does God cause the affairs of man and nature to cross? I remember talking to the Calvinist theologian, and he says, yes. Pinch me, you know, I can't believe it happened.
So, Steve, what would be your advice to a young person who is interested in studying geology as a creationist? I mean, what advice could you give them?
You got to study conventional geology. No way around it. You have to study it. And I would say go to a university for a minimum of 5 years and absorb the uniformitarian and evolutionary science that they offer. But you got to be militant at basically rethinking the thinking pattern that they're going to offer you at the university, and think outside the box. And you got to think about creation and the flood. And that's the great thing about what we're on about, is God has in the Bible basically the framework of for thinking in the Bible. And so you got to be ready to contend with the dinosaur disappointment. And it was as a kid, it was a very disappointing experience. They had the wrong head on Brontosaurus and never existed. And the park in which the Jurassic Park in which he was munching on the ferns at the bank of the river, that's a fiction too. He was buried in some kind of marine disaster. Okay, and you got to start thinking that way. You can't think the normal way of thinking. That's my advice. So go to school, but you got to critique the system, and you got to know that there is a quasi-science or a science-sounding agenda that's driving geology, and you got to go beyond that and get to the good interpretation of geologic data. So you got to go at least 5 years at a major university to encounter the subjects you need to explore this new domain. And then from there, you probably do graduate work at the university on disproving a theory, for example. That's what I'd recommend. I disproved the origin of a coal bed from a swamp, but you could do some, another. The next generation needs to be encouraged to generate outside the box thinking about, well, the origin of limestone, mass kill fossil deposits, origin of canyons. So study catastrophic process like Mount St. Helens. It just happened to come along at the right time, and then do your graduate school. And graduate school can be detailed, but you want to select a subject, and select a useful subject, one that directly impacts the agenda-driven science that we have today.
That's very good advice.
I
that's
see
been that's been
Todd
brilliant.
shaking his head a little bit too.
Yeah.
So,
No, I've been
Todd
enjoying.
is kind of a paleontologist, right?
Well,
And I'm an offense to somebody like him, because I see fossils as interesting sedimentary
yes,
objects.
as
They're not
rocks,
ones that are worried about.
Yes,
Okay.
yeah.
And
And
so
I'm
I
sort
have
of,
a.
I'm clearing away the sediment so I can see the fossil. Yeah, it's a different
Right. He
thing.
throws away the
Yeah.
sediment. Well, the most interesting thing is what's enclosing the fossil. They're sedimentary objects within the geologic deposit.
Oh, that's been brilliant. There are so many things that we haven't talked about. We haven't talked about racetrack flumes with mudstone deposition, or I know as well a paper that you published on the Capitan Reef Complex in, out there in Texas, and that would be interesting to talk about. So many things, that we could have touched on, things that you've published over the years, Steve. But that was brilliant as an overview of a life in creation geology. And I hope it's an inspiration to many of our listeners, some of whom may be interested in going on and studying geology, and maybe they'll be that next generation. thank you so much for joining us.
If you want to hear the boring science behind the limestone layer in Grand Canyon or the terrace evidence in northeastern Arizona for the big lake the size of Lake Michigan, something like that, you can find that. It's around, okay? But we need to tell the story in an overview.
Yeah. We do. Yeah. It's a great story. What a fantastic career.
Okay. The other, I don't like being talking geology except in front of rocks, right? Even PowerPoint is an inferior mode to experience rocks. You have to go out and find the fossils yourself, and you got to ask the right questions. So asking the right questions and developing the right observation skills. So you got to go out and leave the laboratory behind. You need to get out in the field, ask the right questions, and then generate the correct observations about and develop the science.
Yeah. Well, Todd, there's a challenge for us. We're going to have to do that. We're going to have to go out in the field with Steve and record something out in front of the rocks.
So. I guess. I mean, if we have to, we have to. What are we going to do?
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. Well, now here's, have you got a minute?
Yeah, sure.
Why not make it a, this sounds wild. I know a friend of mine who can land a 12-seat Otter aircraft on a glacier in Alaska at 17,000 feet. Okay. We could start the lecture at 17,000 feet on a glacier. Okay. We can patch into the satellite, and then we can record the next segment of the lecture, say on on McCall Ridge at 7,000 feet elevation. I know he can land there. Okay. And he can bring 12-seater aircraft, so he could bring us all along, and then he could fly the Copper River, which is a Chittenden River upstream, Copper River downstream, and he could land on the shore of the Gulf of Alaska at sea level. He can do the flight in 45 minutes. Okay, and we could be patched up in between the lecture sites with sound in on the seat of the aircraft, going by landmarks and then landing at these key places, and then wouldn't that be cool? And
that would be very cool.
and then at the end of the podcast, hey, are there any questions for you guys? And then open it to questions. We're on the Gulf of Alaska with the 12-seater Otter aircraft sitting there.
That would be something.
Open for questions.
If anyone would like to make
it. How many people are going to want to talk about evolution during that? Nah, nobody's going to want to talk about evolution. They're going to talk about what is there, right?
Yeah. So. If anybody wants to sponsor that trip, Do make a contribution at letstalkcreation.org.
Yep, that's right. Yeah, let's make that happen. We're going to call it a day there. Thank you so much, Steve, for joining us. We do hope you'll come back on as a guest, and we'll do some other things together on the podcast. That's been absolutely brilliant. Listeners, viewers, I don't know what's coming next. Magical mystery tour as usual. So join us in a couple of weeks' time, and we'll see you then.
See ya.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Let's Talk Creation. For more information, visit us at letstalkcreation.org, where you'll find an archive of past episodes and all our show notes. If you'd like to leave a comment or make a suggestion, you can find us on all the major social media platforms. Let's Talk Creation is brought to you in the U.S. by Core Academy of Science and in the U.K. by Biblical Creation Trust. As a listener-supported ministry, we are grateful for all of your financial support. Find out how you can make a contribution at our website, letstalkcreation.org. Also, remember to like, subscribe, and share this episode with your friends. Thanks, and see you next time.